Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
Leonard Nimoy, and the theme from Star Trek from his debut album, Leonard Nimoy Presents Mr. Spock's Music from Outer Space. And it was released in June 1967 on the Dot record label.
All about the ears, of course. Spock, we love him. You know, I didn't realise that... I did not realise that Star Trek started so early.
It was really old, actually, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I didn't really, you know, because I remember watching Star Trek, because I always wanted to be an astronaut. I always wanted to be in space, you know. It's one of those things.
So do I.
Yeah.
That's why the house is full of robots and Star Wars characters.
Well, no, our house is like a 70s...
Danger, danger, 60s, Will Robinson type thing, yeah.
And, you know, and Spock was the symbol of... otherworldliness, wasn't he, really? Because, you know, Kirk was all very
macho. He was like the space alien Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, you know, and this logic thing, the whole theory behind Star Trek and the whole story and the characters were fantastic. That's why it lasted so long. I mean, you know, he was still playing it until 2013.
So he started off with a pilot in 1964. And he got nominated for three times for an Emmy Award as well. Mm. And all this happened with Leonard Nimoy. Because let's talk about Leonard Nimoy, because when you look into his life, you have no idea how amazingly talented this guy was.
Okay.
So he's an actor, a film director, a photographer, an author, a singer,
blimey,
and a songwriter. Leonard Simon Nimoy.
No.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
No. He was born in Boston in 1931. He was the son of Dora and Max, who are Jewish immigrants from Izaslav in the Ukraine.
Wow.
And when they left the Ukraine, they had to leave separately. So his father walked across the border into Poland, and his mother and his grandmother were smuggled out the Soviet Union in a horse-drawn wagon by hiding under bales of hay. So he began acting at the age of 8 in local children's neighbourhood theatre with lots of different jobs, from selling newspapers, shining shoes, to selling vacuum cleaners. And his parents wanted to get him a stable job, or, it says, even learn to play the accordion. It's like, what's that about? So he could always earn a living. So in those days, you know, being able to play the accordion, obviously... got you a living. But his grandfather was really cool, and he encouraged him to do what he really wanted to do, which was to be an actor. He already had a great singing voice as well. So when he had his bar mitzvah, apparently the week after he was asked to go and sing for somebody else as well because he was that good. And he began his career in the early in his early 20s teaching acting classes in Hollywood and making some minor film and television appearances.
Okay.
And how this record came about, I know I'm talking a lot, but this is just lovely because I wanted to open the show with this because how 1967 was that? I mean, it was just the whole feel. I mean, I know it's spacey. But
well, you know what I was listening to? Firstly, and you're not going to like this
what?
At all, but the bass, that it's played again with a pick. It's played with a pick. That's how they get that attack. And I'm afraid it looks like I think we're going to have to get the pick out.
Well, you're going to have to stick one with super glue to my finger.
Well, yeah, I think we are because it's definitely the sound of that era, that pick thing going on, because you can hear the pick at the beginning with flat wound strings again. It's got that impact, you know. And also that guitar on it is like, to try and make it spacey, they've got like a tremolo on.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
Is a tremolo is like a device. It used to be in the old days in an amp, and we have them in amps. Now you buy little pedals that were with them, and they don't sound as good, but the amps sound best. But virtually there, the tremolo, it was so fierce, like the volume oscillation between zero and loud, because it basically oscillates. It always goes wah, 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 like that sort
yeah,
of, you know.
Yeah.
And it was so fierce, it was like choppy, you know. It's going dugga 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 dugga,
yeah,
da 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 da. And really interesting, you know. And because they had to try and find some way of creating something that sounded otherworldly and spacey, didn't they?
Yeah, that's. And did you notice those backing vocals for the ladies? Oh.
Yeah, that is. I can imagine you doing that, darling. It was very, very. You know.
Well, it's actually listed as outsider music.
Is that right?
Yeah, because I'm really into outsider art, as you know, with I've got some Cristo paintings and stuff, and I love that kind of punk graffiti fusion of attitude. But Charles Green of Dot Records, he'd arranged with the studio as well, you know, to do an album of space music, and it was his daughter who was a fan of Star Trek.
Is that right?
No. Yeah, and she, because he was going to do an album of music based on Star Trek, and she said, well, why don't you get Mr. Spock to be actually on the album? So he approached him. And he didn't realise he had such a great, later on in different songs, he has a great singing voice. So it apparently was well received as well. So they signed him up for a 5-record contract. I know.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And Buzz Aldrin said that Nimoy was a fellow space traveller because he helped make the journey into the final frontier accessible to us all.
I love the colourful clothes you wear. And the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. I hear the sound of a gentle wind on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me somehow closer now. Softly smile, I know she must be kind. In her eyes, she goes with me to a blossom room.
I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations.
Thank you. vibrations are happening with her. Gotta keep those loving good vibrations are happening with her. Gotta keep those loving good vibrations.
Beach Boys, Good Vibrations, from their 12th studio album, Smiley Smile, released on the 18th September 1967 on both Capitol and Brother Records. It was released as a single the year before, though, on the 10th of October, where it was an immediate critical and commercial hit, of course, topping charts in several countries, including the US and the UK. The album reached number 9 in the UK, but didn't sell very well in the US, peaking at number 41. A lot of people thought Heroes and Villains was bad. It's a great song off this album. Great. Mm-hmm. And this is fantastic. It is the sound of excellence. It's the sound of creative minds doing really interesting stuff. Because the year before, in 66, Pet Sounds scared the life out of the Beatles because it was so good. And people didn't know where it came from. All of a sudden, they did that and they thought, oh, no. And Lennon and McCartney, I remember. And if you listen to some of the songs, some of the albums after that and songs that Lennon and McCartney did, they were clearly influenced and ripped off, I would say, some of the Beach Boys stuff and their invention. I mean, here, apparently, Brian Wilson had a swimming pool, a virtually Olympic-sized swimming pool, because they were making a lot of money, and it was empty, and the vocals were recorded in the swimming pool because they were using all old, essentially old broadcast equipment. They weren't really using a proper studio, per se. And so what they did, they got the whole band in the bottom of the swimming pool and recorded them in there. It's amazing.
It's great,
but that is a brilliant thing to do. This is the reason why it sounds so good, because it was innovative, but they're using natural stuff, you know. And also, when they were recording it, they'd be recording a verse and a chorus on different reels of tape at different times, and then they had to splice it together. When they did the mix down of the album, they went to Wally Hyder's studio. Now, the funny thing about Wally Hyder's studio is that our mate in the Isle of Man, Mark Cleese, a very good friend of ours, in his studio, he has two of the API preamps from Wally Hyder's studio. So it may be. Beach Boys sang through those. But anyway, I certainly know that Crosby, Stills, Nash did. But anyway, back to Good Vibrations. And so what they did, they went to Wally Hyder's studio and they took these bits of tape and basically joined them all together and spliced them. But they had to do things like backing vocals on the fly to actually... And actually get all the levels right. Because if you're doing two different tapes, two different times, it's a nightmare. It's not like Pro Tools, like digital. You can't see what you're doing. You have to listen to it. And you look at the meters, which were quite primitive then, you know. Mm. And it's really tricky.
Mm. They actually were using their ears to listen as opposed to eyes.
Exactly.
That's what people do today.
And they produced this masterpiece. And the funny thing is that after the Spock's space ding, ding, outer world know. Thing, that sort of, that sound in Good Vibrations, you know, it sounds very space age, doesn't it?
It does. I went to see the Beach Boys in concert, but Brian Wilson, Brian wasn't with them.
Yeah.
It was a bit weird because the two guys at the front, there was that, is it Mike Love?
Yeah.
He was like, obviously he's an older chap now, but he still thought he was a love machine from the 60s. And he kept like, he had this hand that was just littered with gold rings and he kept pointing at ladies in the audience and winking and putting his finger at him as if to say, I can have you, baby. I love you, baby. You know, and I was just kind of going, what are you doing, man? But what I loved and I'm not trying to judge. I just, you know, you have to kind of laugh. But it was a beautiful thing. Just, and some of the guys were singing some of the higher, you know, on Good Vibrations.
Yeah.
But, you know, he still did the, oh, good, did the low bit. But, yeah, it was great to see them because they're iconic. They really are. It's a fantastic band, and it's such a sound of that era. That's the thing. They are the 60s.
Well, they are, and that whole, you know, that whole beach thing, that whole surfing thing, the whole surfing USA, that is what, even I remember it, because in the early 70s when I was sort of getting into music, everybody used to go, it was very exotic, you know, we had surfboards and all that sort of thing. And yeah. I remember seeing pictures of them, and it was all very West Coast, you know?
Yeah.
And even now when you go to California and, you know, and you go to LA and you go on the beaches and down to Laguna Beach and stuff, that sort of whole thing is still happening, isn't it?
It is. And do you know what? The light there, I think when I went there, the light, it's like the light in Spain. When you've got this beautiful, warm climate, it makes you feel a bit surreal, as if you're in a movie.
Yeah.
It really does. It's very odd. But the thing is that Smile, the album they were working on before, it got shelved. And they were under pressure to present an album to Capitol. And what they did is they just, instead of going for this really sort of intense album, because Brian Wilson used to get really, well, I think they were getting really, really stressed out.
Yeah.
They decided to turn it on its head and do a lo-fi version of Smile, but to start over. And he said it was the best time they've had. They got so close again. They had a great time, and I really like that story. You know that the band actually have great memories of recording that album. That screaming, it's the Birds, and So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star. It sounds like Liam Gallagher, and that's from their fourth album, Younger Than Yesterday, released on the 6th of February 1967 on Columbia Records. It was written by Roger McGuinn and Chris Hillman, and it was inspired by the manufactured nature of bands like the Monkees, and also released as a single on the 9th of January, where it reached number 29 on the Billboard Hot 100 charts, but it failed to chart in the UK.
9th of January, my birthday, and also the birthday of Jimmy Page.
There
we go, yeah.
Get in there.
So, the Birds, all about Roger McGuinn. And there's a bit of confusion because on Wikipedia, they say it's Jim McGuinn. Yeah. That's his main name. But anyway, we definitely know him as Roger McGuinn.
Roger. Roger.
And yes, the king of the Wickenbacker 12-string guitar.
Nice.
That later on, of course, Tom Petty sort of adopted that sort of sound because, you know, when Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers started, he used to use a lot of that 12-string as well, obviously inspired by Roger McGuinn.
Yeah.
But there's not an awful lot of it on there. It's just that opening line.
Yeah.
And I know I've talked about it before, but when they're recording those 12 strings, or when he did, he used a couple of compressors, 1176s, in the studio, which are a Urie thing, a Urie device, straight into the mixing console. And it's very unusual, so he didn't actually go to an amp. And on there, it does sound very dull, the sound of his guitar, which is correct, you know? Yeah. It's sort of thing correct. And the other interesting thing about the Rickenbacker 12 string is that the thick string, I don't really know, but there's 12 strings on obviously on a 12 string, but the bottom strings have a string an octave apart. So a thick one and a thin one. And the Gibson 12 strings, and most of the acoustics out there, have the thin string first, but on a Rickenbacker, they have the thick string first. So when you do a downstroke on the pick, the first thing you hit is the thick string rather than the thin, and it actually changes the sound of the instrument. We have a double neck, which is a Mosrite, and the guy, the Mosrite himself, the guy, Mosler, I think he was called, he used to work at the Rickenbacker factory, so he actually does it the same way. So our 12 string is the same basically as a Rickenbacker. So there you are, a little bit of trivia for you there about the Rickenbacker. Let's go on to the birds.
Well, the thing is as well with the Rickenbacker, it says in Wiki, I love this, is that the jangly 12 string guitar was absorbed into the vocabulary of rock. It's very dramatic, a bit like us really at times, isn't it, really? And said that the band were like influential in originating psychedelic rock and ragga rock. I love all the wagga walk. See, here we go again. And they were also pioneering in the development of country rock, especially with their 1968 album, Sweetheart of the Rodeo.
Now, that Sweetheart of the Rodeo is the name of a band in the United States out of Nashville, Janice Oliver and her wonderful sister,
Christine Arnold.
That's right, yeah. And
we went to one of the rehearsals, didn't we?
We did.
In Nashville, baby.
Yeah, that's right, with Monty Hitchcock, the manager.
He was also
the manager, Emmylou Harris, and we were hanging out, and it was very funny. And I knocked a bottle of beer over. Went terrible. I wasn't drunk or anything. I just knocked it over my foot. Very embarrassing. Anyway, one of them things.
Yeah. But I didn't know that's where they got the name from for the band, obviously.
Yeah, obviously, yeah.
So it's well cool. And there's and also what the other thing about this one record that I want to say about is the trumpet, because it's a South African musician called Hugh Masekela.
Yeah, Masekela. Yeah, very Kayla. Famous. Yeah,
so I'd never heard his name before. Yeah, but that was the first time at Brass. It was on the Birds recording as well.
Well, that's right, and that's probably why the 12 string's quite back in the mix. But I mean, it was a superstar band because I mean, this band spawned Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. It also spawned Manassas, because Chris Hillman, the bass player, joined it with Stephen Stills, and did Manassas. And of course, David Crosby and Stephen Stills went on to do Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. You know, and it was a very formative band, I think, in the whole sound of America. And what I like about it, it's a bit of a bridge between that West Coast sort of sound and the rock sort of sound. And it is a bit country rock in a way, you know.
Yeah.
But great songs. And one thing I just need to mention about the last track before we move off the Birds.
Okay.
Right, we are going to move off the Birds. We're going to move back onto the Beach Boys, because I forgot to mention that sound in the is done with an electro theremin. And what it is, a theremin, it's an aerial with like a tone generator. And
as you get thermometer closer, for your bottom.
Well, it looks like it. And as you put your hand near it or your body, it actually goes up in pitch. So as you move and it goes, and
it's
back.
Really
and
odd.
Jimmy Page used one with Led Zeppelin in like his experimental sections and everything. And to play them is fiendishly difficult. We've got one.
You could play it with your eyelashes.
Well, you can. Even if you breathe, you can actually put it out of tune, because you've got to use your hand and you do it in a very specific way. But it's beautifully in tune, which is absolutely incredible. So they are a bit of theremin
action.
Action, yes. With the Beach Boys.
Drifting and drifting. Yeah, you know I didn't miss dreams.
Paul Butterfield Band, Drifting and Drifting, from their third studio album, The Resurrection of Pig Boy Crabshaw. Great name. Released in December 1967 by Elektra Records, reached number 52 in the album charts. Now, Paul Butterfield Band was very closely aligned with John Mayall and the Blues Breakers. And in fact, he brought his Chicago-style sort of harmonica player, who's principally a harmonica player and singer, is Paul Butterfield, to England. And this was really, his band, the Paul Butterfield Band, was really the equivalent, the American equivalent of what John Mayall was doing.
Right, that makes sense.
But John Mayall started first. And it all it, and this was like this fusion. This is where the British invasion, i.e., when the blues guys went back over to America with their own music and told them how to play it, really, because they were listening to the black Chicago guys and the black guys from, you know, ever since about the 30s and 20s and stuff, all the way up to the 50s. And the 60s, and you know, and regurgitated it, sold it back. And the Paul Butterfield Band was really a sort of reaction to that whole thing.
Wow.
Now, also, Mike Bloomfield, the legendary guitar player, is not on this track, which I'm gutted because I thought he was on it, but he's not.
No.
It's Elvin Bishop.
Elvin.
That's right. Not Elvis, but Elvin.
Yeah.
Bishop. And
not Alvin, Elvin.
No, that's right. Not Alvin Lee, Elvin Bishop. But Mike Bloomfield, of course, the guitar player, was the guitar player in the band before, and he did a lot of extended jams with Elvin in the band before. And Bloomfield was known for turning down Bob Dylan to form his touring electric band. And that's when they got the band in.
That's right, but they did back him for his very, very first ever performance, electric performance, at the Newport Folk Festival in 65, but they didn't go on tour with him.
Right. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, ooh, you've done some stuff up there.
10 points to Gryffindor.
Right, okay, 10 points down.
Get in there. Okay, go on then. Well, the Paul Butterfield Band, just listening to that song, it's blues. It feels authentic, doesn't it? It feels, and there's so much space. And if you're going to love a blues song, that is an actual cover of an original blues song called Drifting Blues. That was one of the biggest blues hits of the 1940s. And it helped define like the growing post-war West Coast kind of blues style. And it was written by Eddie Williams, Johnny Moore, and a young chap called Charles Brown, who was still in high school
at
the time. And this is what I love as well, because it's a little bit like a Ray Charles story, because Brown's inspiration for the tune was a gospel song his grandmother had taught him, and he felt uneasy about mixing gospel and blues. But Johnny Otis and some others helped convince him to go ahead, and they recorded it in 1945 with Johnny Moore's Three Blazers.
No.
Great name, yep. And they became a popular kind of attraction at Hollywood area nightclubs, and their style at that point became known as club blues. So the jump blues was popular in dance halls, and the club blues was more suited to an intimate musical setting.
Well, that's what Ray Charles did. Charles, they said he took like gospel music and then turned it into, but that was in the late 50s.
Yeah.
So these guys did it 10 years. That's amazing.
I know. And the thing is that I didn't really know anything about Paul Butterfield either, you know, but he was classically trained as a flautist.
No.
Then he developed an interest in blues, and he was hanging out in the Chicago blues scene. And this is what gets me. You can hear it dripping in authenticity from that Chicago sound. He used to hang out with Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and Little Walter,
right,
and Otis Rush, and they encouraged him to get to the jam sessions. And what do you always say to me?
You need to go to jam sessions.
I know, and I'm actually not so bad now with jams when we go to them. But I remember deliberately getting drunk on white wine before
you did.
I did, didn't I? When we were in Spain, I'm like, yeah. Oh no, I don't know if I want to play.
And then I got you up to play.
You
and
set
it was
me
a
up.
Disaster, yeah. But anyway,
but jams are really good. So he formed the Paul Butterfield Band in 1963, and he recorded loads of successful albums, and he did the circuit. He played at the Fillmore West in San Francisco, the Fillmore East in New York City, and they also played at the Monterey Pop Festival and Woodstock.
And this has got David Sanborn.
I know.
A young David Sanborn on sax in the background there. And the interesting thing about this song, which you have forgotten, and I'm going to parry you with my knowledge here.
Come on then, bring it on, the sunshine.
This track was also recorded by Eric Clapton on EC Was Here, Drifting Blues in an acoustic version, but you've forgotten. So there you are. I raise you.
You got me.
There's a girl in my life, the best little girl that I could ever find. Her lips are warm when the nights are cold. In the summertime she can make it snow. She's all right, she's all right. If you wanna get a girl that's really fine, you gotta get a girl like mine. She's alright, she's alright. You take your girl to a show, you gotta stand in line, but she says no. You finally get your ticket and you walk in. There she's standing with a silly grin, but not mine. She'll stand in line. If you wanna get a girl that's truly fine, you gotta get a girl like mine. She's alright, she's alright. You buy your girl a fancy dress, that's the only way she'll look her best. I give my girl bell-bottom slacks, a big white belt, and she's a gas. She's alright, she's alright. If you wanna get a girl that's really fine, you gotta get a girl, a girl like mine, 'cause she's alright, she's alright. A girl like mine, she's alright. A girl like mine.
The Caruso of rock, the big O, Roy Orbison, A Girl Like Mine, from his 12th album, Cry Softly, Lonely One. Released in October 1967 by MGM Records. It was produced by Wesley Rose and Jim Vienna, not Vienno, who also produced Hey, Good Looking, What You Got Cooking, one of my favourite country songs by Hank Williams.
And your mother's, I believe.
Yeah.
She used to love that song.
She did, actually.
I never met her, but I feel like I know her.
Yeah, well, you would do. Yeah. When I laugh, you hear my mum.
I certainly do.
That's true, actually. I'm getting more like her as I get older. So, yes, that's Roy Orbison. So that album, title track, hit number 52 in the US, right, and number 10 in Australia. But had he released that album just a few years earlier, any of its 12 tracks could have been contenders for singles.
Is that right?
Yeah, because what happened by late 67, the music scene was fractured, but he was like being really prolific at the time, and it could have worked against him because he'd already released that year the soundtrack to the film The Fastest Guitar Alive and a full-length tribute to country artist Don Gibson.
Mm.
And so some critics say that he kind of confused the record-buying public. Because they didn't, you know, what Bob Dylan used to say about him, you never know where you are with Roy, whether you're listening to mariachi or opera. He always kept you on your toes.
Well, he's got one of the greatest voices in rock.
He's a darling, isn't he?
Yeah.
Roy Orbison is a darling.
Yeah, those vocals he did, some of them are just outstandingly beautiful, you know. He had such a powerful voice.
Yeah.
And he had a very strong look, didn't he? I mean, that look, you could always tell it was him, those dark glasses. And
his dyed hair. Yeah. Dark, very dark.
You know, but he was a titan of the industry.
That's a nice
of course.
Word.
And when he you know, he worked with the Traveling Wilburys later on, you know. I remember that it was Tom Petty, who's no slouch himself, and he said he was terrified going in the room, and George Harrison, they were terrified going in a room with him, this Roy Orbison, and Bob Dylan, because they were both in the band, and I mean, these guys are heavy duty, you know.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I can imagine that as well. Well, that was like this kind of, you know, with this counterculture era we're looking at now, you had like Jimi Hendrix dominating the charts, Jefferson Airplane, the Rolling Stones and the Doors, and Roy did actually said that he felt a bit lost and a bit directionless. He said he didn't hear a lot he could relate to. So he said, I kind of stood there like a tree where the winds blow and the seasons change, and you're still there and you bloom again.
It's hard for you, my baby, because it's hard for me, my baby, and the darkest hour is just before dawn.
Each night before you go to bed,
dedicated to the one.
listening to The Supertone Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that was The Mamas and the Papas, dedicated to the one I love, released as a single in February 1967 on the Dunhill record label. Nothing to do with the cigarette brand there, I don't think. Went to number two in the UK records retail charts, 15 in the Netherlands, 26 in West Germany, 2 in the Billboard Hot 100. But it was kept off the top spot by Happy Together by the Turtles, and that is another unbelievable record. But this is the another sound of the 60s.
It is.
This series, now we're in number five, I think.
That's right.
All about 1967. And we're still going. We still cannot find any really bad records that were done in 67. Well, I'm sure there are, but, you know, I mean, to do five shows out of 1 year is unbelievable. And each track is great.
We've got more shows as well I've programmed.
This is absolutely a sensational song. And those vocal harmonies. And I'm afraid, again, I'm going to bring it up.
What?
The bass guitar with flat wound strings and a pick. There, it's very prevalent. It was picking like a picking thing. Bonk, bonk, bonk. That's what it was doing.
Well, bonk, bonk, bonk. It wasn't Carol Kay. It was Joe Osborne on bass.
Joe Osborne?
Yeah, but it was Hal
with
Blaine.
The Osbournes.
No.
Oh, but that's Wrecking Crew.
Wrecking Crew, yeah. Hal Blaine on drums. Larry Knechtel, on the keys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. What a great sound.
I love that, though, and that was the first time that Michelle Phillips had been given the lead vocals over Cass Elliot.
Is that right?
Yeah, and Time magazine had described Michelle as the purest soprano in pop music. And I didn't know that Michelle Phillips actually co-wrote California Dreaming.
No, is that
right? It's just absolutely cool. When you look at the Mamas and Papas, and this is something I did not know, they were a defining force in the music scene of the counterculture of the 60s. Mm. And you know, I know they sang it, but they'd released a total of 5 studio albums and they had 17 singles just over a 4-year period. And they've sold close to 40 million records worldwide. I mean, it's crazy.
That is outrageous.
It is, isn't it? And it was also part of their, this is what I love this story behind this as well, that it was on their third studio album called Deliver, which charted at number 2 in the Billboard Top Pop Albums in 67. Mm. It was a bit of an in-joke, you see, because Cass Elliot had just told the band that she was pregnant before recording started.
Ah.
But at that time, being an unwed mother, there was a big stigma about it, so it was kept secret from the public.
Wow.
And so the LP's name was just meant to imply that, you know, they were going to deliver this newborn creative kind of creation as opposed to, I mean, that sounded like sheep. I can't really do a baby. But you know what I mean? Yeah.
Don't
Sam and Dave. Great song. Soul Man releases a single in September 67 and released on the Stax Atlantic Records label. It was the most successful Stax single to date on its release. It peaked at number one on the Billboard Hot Black Singles chart and number two on the Billboard Hot 100 charts. It was kept from the top spot by To Sir With Love by Lulu. Lulu! You just don't realise that she was big in America.
No.
Because when you're growing up, you just kind of see her in the UK. And you That's have right, no idea yeah. that she had this kind of, you know, little... she's a powerhouse.
It was a film, wasn't it? Sir With Love. It was a film, wasn't it, I think? Anyway,
and it also won Grammy for Best Rhythm and Blues Group Performance, Vocal or Instrumental in 68.
Right. So it's a great song.
Yes.
When you put it on, it sounds fantastic.
Yes.
It was recorded at the Stax Studio. So, you know, which it was a legendary studio, but it just sounds alive and beautiful. And it's all down to Booker T and the MGs because they were the backing band for Sam and Dave. Of course, it's a great vocal. So. And, you know, Booker T. Jones, the Colonel Steve Cropper on guitar, Al Jackson Jr. on drums, and Donald Duck Dunn on bass.
Oh, Duck Dunn.
You know, and that guitar line, it's iconic, but that is one of his classic ones. He's into Green Onions, you know, and he plays on that, of course, Steve Cropper. But that double stop thing he does is just sensational. And it's got such swing to it, which I can tell you, when you play, because I've actually played this as a session guy, and, in bands, and it is very difficult to get that swing.
Yeah,
the whole band's got to have the swing, but the guitar is really difficult to swing because it's the way it is, you know, it's really hard. Anyway, there you are.
And the song was written by David Porter and Isaac Hayes. And he was inspired to write the song after he saw on TV the aftermath of the 12th Street riots in Detroit, Michigan. Mm. And black residents there had marked buildings that were mostly African-American-owned institutions that had not been destroyed during the riots with the word soul.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, that's a beautiful story.
I'm just mad about saffron. Well, saffron's mad about me. I'm just mad about saffron. She's just mad about me. They call me mellow yellow, quite rightly. They call me mellow yellow, quite rightly. They call me mellow yellow. Mad about 14. 14's mad about me. I'm but just mad about 14. She's just mad about me. They call me mellow yellow. They call me mellow yellow. Quite rightly. They call me mellow yellow. To fly, a wind of a velocity nil. Born a high forever to fly. If you watch cup power fill, they call me mellow yellow. Quite rightly, they call me mellow yellow. Quite rightly, they call me mellow yellow. Sudden craze, electrical banana is
bound to be the very next phase. They call it mellow yellow.
Quite rightly.
They call me mellow yellow.
Quite rightly.
They call me mellow yellow.
Donovan, Mellow Yellow, released as a single in February 1967 in the UK on Pye Records, where it peaked at number 8, and it was released in the USA in 1966, October, when it reached number 2 in the Billboard Hot 100. And Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys, of course, and Winchester Cathedral by the New Vaudeville Band kept it from getting to number 1. Also released on his fourth album, Mellow Yellow. And the electrical banana reference in there is all about ladies' vibrators, which I didn't know. Fascinating stuff.
I'm glad you said that. That was in the bottom of the notes.
Yeah, well,
they did say it was rumoured to be about smoking dry banana skins, but which was supposed to be believed to be an hallucinogenic drug in the 60s. But later he said it was about being cool, laid back and electrical bananas.
Well, let's not talk about electrical bananas and vibrators. Let's talk about the bass. John Paul Jones played bass on that. Bobby Orr on drums. And it was produced by Mickey Most and recorded at Abbey Road. What I love about that bass, actually, because the drums are quite straight. And if you listen, you can tell it's somebody really good because he just picks it up just before da-do. A really lovely little line that really drives the song along, you know? Anyway, that's a bit of...
I saw Donovan.
Yeah.
At the Green Man Festival.
Oh.
I just turned up that night and Kerris Matthews was on just after him, actually.
Ah.
And I wanted to just stand there. When I'm in these festival fields, I like to just close my eyes and imagine I'm back in the 60s or something, you know, or just to absorb the music. And it was cool. He name dropped like after every song, which he's got this amazing history of having met everyone and he was there. That's the thing.
Anyway, that's the end of the show, I'm afraid.
I know.
Show 5 from 1967.
And next week's going to be our 100th Supertone show.
So we're still on 1967, but we're going to pick some special songs from that. And we'll look forward to speaking to you and broadcasting
Sharing, yes.
next time.